Hey there. Before we hit the intro, I want to let you know we're launching a search for a co-host. I'm going to be exploring potential candidates, and I want you guys to be the first to know. You are welcome to nominate yourself or someone you know, maybe even someone you don't know but think would be a good match. But do know that this is going to be a tough bill to fill. Please reach out to us via the website or social media to pitch your ideas, and I will explain more on the tail end of the episode. This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art world. I am Michael Shaw. Happy holidays 2019. Welcome to the show. It's episode 257 with Nick Brown. He is a Los Angeles-based painter and the director of the David Whaley Foundation, which gives various artist grants. So he has been on both sides of the grant process. And he tells me all about it. Among many other things we discussed, Nick also shared a very useful anecdote involving the application-based New American Painting magazine, which I know you will appreciate. The website for this podcast is still theconversationpod.com. Please do me a favor and yourself a favor. Go check it out for a few minutes. Check out Nick's work. Scroll the archive of past guests. Consider the various ways you can support the show at this end of your stretch. With all that said, let us dive into the conversation with Nick Brown. Talk to you more on the back end. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is you've been teaching for a while, right? You've taught UCLA Extension most recently. And where did you teach before that?
I taught at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and I taught at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where I went to grad school and undergrad, actually.
Okay, got it. And one of the things that we talked about before that I really wanted to hear more about is, at one point, I guess when you were living in New York, you realized that you needed to teach less or even give up some teaching so that you could make more money bartending. Well, you want to tell me about that story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the overheads in New York are so expensive, and teaching as a profession has been so grossly diminished. You can't just rely like on one income or just teaching for most people. I mean, being a professor in this country now nationally, that it's 70% of all faculty are adjunct. So you're getting one or two classes tops anywhere. There's no benefits or anything like that. So, you know, it's an hourly paid job now is what it is. And so anyway, I was teaching at Pratt, and I was teaching at a little private school that was a portfolio preparation school to help students get into college and bartending at the same time. So I was bartending like four nights a week and teaching, you know, three, 4 days a week. And, in the daytime, and I obviously bartend at night. So at some point, I got asked to go and work at this other bar, a very, very busy bar called Union Hall, and which is in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And I went and I filled in for the weekend, and they really liked me. And I made so much money over the weekend. I was like completely taken aback because it was such a busy place. And then they called me and offered me like a full-time job there, like, you know, bartending four nights a week. And it was like the weekend as well. So, you know, even better. So I had to think about it half a minute, but I ended up quitting, you know, all my teaching jobs to bartend four nights a week because, you know, you just can't be pretentious and say, oh, well, I'm a professor, you know. it's a job, and the job is to facilitate me making artwork. So, you know, you got to take the job that's paying the most money. So in the end, that's what I did. I was just bartending at the end there.
Right. And it sounds like you had pretty good overhead with the money you were making as a bartender.
Yeah. I mean, I was probably making three times as much money bartending as I was being a professor, and teaching at this little school. But, you know, that was when I was able to start saving some money, but I never went out. You know, I just worked. And when you bartend, you tend to build these relationships with other bartenders. So when I did go out, I only drank at places where I could drink for free, you know, and you were reciprocating with those people too.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a, you know, unwritten, understood thing. So I was able to save, you know, a substantial amount of money over the couple years. And then, you know, and had planned to move out here. I didn't necessarily know I'd be able to buy a house, but like, you know, that was the plan. So, you know, I spent all my time literally like at work or in the studio. I was in the studio 35 hours a week, you know, even though, and I was working another like 30 plus hours a week. So all that money was just going into, you know, my overheads, my art, and then I was able to save the rest. So that worked out well.
Do you mind my asking, just to, for comparison's sake, can you give me a ballpark of like what you slash an adjunct teacher would make, say, in a day or in a week, and what you made as a bartender in a week?
Well, if you're talking about a week, you know, I probably could make $1,200 in a week bartending. And, you know, you might make $300 to $600 teaching, adjunct teaching in a week.
Mm-hmm. If you had three classes, you would make the upper end of that.
Yeah, two or three classes, depending where you're working and what they're paying. But yeah.
Okay, got it. About your work, I think the moving your production, you know, sort of factoring in, I got to move this studio in 10 years plus, you know, of work with me. And one of the things that stood out when we spoke before is that your work is heavy and hard to move around, probably. They're substantial objects, right? So without getting into maybe too much of like the translating visual into audio, I'm interested in the story of the weightiness. Maybe you can start kind of wherever, maybe, but I'm interested about the substantial objecthood of these things.
Yeah, sure. I mean, really, they're basically, you know, abstract landscape paintings that are dealing with the ephemerality of life and nature itself, which really encompasses like the Anthropocene now that we're doing a real good job of destroying it.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So that takes on a kind of political aspect as well, that's subtle, but it's there. And for me, they're also like a part of really like a spiritual kind of practice. You know, I'd say my belief system sort of tends, you know, towards being pagan. And so there's a spiritual aspect and a political aspect to the work. And then there's objects that get set into the paintings as well that, you know, have symbolic and metaphorical kind of purposes. And the range of the viscosity of the paint goes from very, very thin to very, very thick, like over an inch thick. And it's all just pure oil paint. And so the large paintings, there's quite a few very large paintings that are 8 feet tall and 6.5 feet wide. And those paintings they're all unstretched. So they don't have like the wooden framework behind them. And so I have to hang them to move them around on these false walls that I build out of 2x2s. And foam core backing to keep them rigid. And so they're a bit unwieldy, and you know, they probably, some of the heavier paintings maybe weigh like 40-50 pounds because of the volume of the paint that's on them.
Mm-hmm.
So and the objects, of course, are adding weight to the work as well. So does that help answer your question?
Yeah, okay. And you also mentioned that there's a, I think you mentioned there's a lot of money, like a grand sometimes of oil paint in these things. And I was thinking, okay, when you build up a lot of, you know, an inch thick, which doesn't sound too thick actually, and 40 or 50 pounds doesn't sound too heavy. But I guess I just wonder if one builds up a lot of thick oil paint, if it has to be the highest quality oil paint all the way from the bottom of the, you know, to the outer edge, you know what I mean? If the integrity
yeah, sure.
of it demands that.
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't really do it in layers like how you're traditionally taught that you would paint. I mean, I do paint like the entire painting thin first, and then there's selected areas that are painted much thicker. And those really thick areas tend to be fairly one shot marks. Sometimes I'll stack like two big, thick, you know, palette knife marks or brush marks on top of each other. It's just part of like the style of how they're painted. So you're not like starting with student grade paint, and as you build outwards, working towards like better quality paints, because it's just this one massive mark. So, anyway, in that regard, I use Gamblin paint, which is a very good, like, middle quality paint.
Right.
And part of the reason I use that brand in particular is it's very stiff out the tube. And so it has a bit more of like a sculptural application with the volume of paint that I'm using. Just other brands that, you know, could be the same quality, but they just mix their paint a bit thinner with the viscosity. And so it's a little sloppier and harder to achieve what I'm trying to do. So that's the rationale for that.
Okay.
And, you know, there's enough pigmentation that it retains its saturation and the color and all of that kind of thing that you're looking for from a higher quality paint. So,
right.
But certainly, you know, I couldn't paint with, like, you know, Blocks or one of these brands that are like three times more expensive. I mean, you know, I'd lose my house, you know? So.
Right. So you are compromising to some extent, but not to the point where it's keeping you from doing what you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is a compromise there, but on the other end, there's a lot of, you know, paintings in museums that are made with Gamblin paint. You know, it's a good solid quality paint. So
yeah, museum validation paint.
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Got it. You have a very interesting day job, working as the director of this foundation. I'd love to hear you tell the origin story of how that happened.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the director of the David Whaley Foundation, and we issue artist grants in the Los Angeles area. So it's Los Angeles plus some of the outlying counties, which I think is important. And because, of course, not everyone can afford to live in Los Angeles. So there's opportunities that we're providing for people who are just outside of Los Angeles as well. So the foundation is named after David Whaley. David was a student of mine when I was teaching at UCLA. Well, I still do, but teach at UCLA Extension. And David took a couple classes with me, and he was actually an amazing student and was having a very good art career of his own. He was trying to just kind of move his work in a bit different direction and thought I was a good candidate to help guide him through that process. He had found my work online and liked it and all that kind of thing. So anyway, David took a couple classes with me and was able to, you know, take this information I was providing him with and put it into fruition, like, immediately. It was really uncanny, actually. And
let me stop you for a second, Nick. Can you just talk about what the class is that you taught? Because you're making it sound like this guy, David, and maybe your other students were artists who were serious artists. Is that right?
Yeah, it's at UCLA Extension. So everybody there, it's non-matriculating students. And a lot of the students have like a day job. Like one of my students I really love is a physicist. Another student works for the Rand Corporation. I mean, you know, they have some pretty serious jobs, but they're also really, really good artists. And you know, they're coming in after work. They're very dedicated. You know, they're not messing around. Like, these people, you know, have a better level of dedication than, say, like my sophomore students at Pratt. You know,
So, is it the type of thing where it's a crit type situation, or are people actually making work in the class?
Yeah, they're making work in classes, studio-based classes. One of them was a great class. It was the first class I had David in, actually, I think. And I was asked to teach a class from Paul Schimmel's last show at MoCA. And the show he did was called Destroy the Picture, Painting the Void, something like that. What the hell was it?
Painting the Void sounds about right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it was called Destroy the Picture. Anyway, so we went over to the museum and had a walkthrough. Well, I did a walkthrough with Paul Schimmel first, and then I taught the class. I gave them a walkthrough based on what he had taught me about it. And then we went back to the class, and the concept was to make work that used some of the strategies that people had gleaned from this exhibition. And so it got really, you know, pushed people into more radical kind of spaces, because that show was amazing, you know, demonstrating all these incredible strategies artists had used over time to kind of, you know, push their mediums forward. Anyway, so David was in that class, and that was he had like a little blowtorch and was like melting wax on paintings and, you know, embedding objects into them and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. It was great. And I had him for a printmaking class I taught. and then another painting class. I think it was advanced painting that he was in. And then I didn't see David for a little bit. He took a few classes with me, and that was that. But then I got a message on Facebook, actually, from David's husband, and it was Norman Buckley. And Norman wrote me this really lovely letter saying that David had passed away and that he wanted to start a foundation in David's name and help support artists, because David was very invested in supporting artists and also teaching. He taught with like underprivileged people and things like that. And so he asked me to be on the board of the foundation. He thought it was important to have an artist on the board. And he said that, you know, I had quite a strong impact on David. And it was very moving and quite unexpected, all of it. And so I agreed to be on the board. And so that was like 3 years ago. And we've been issuing grants for those 3 years. And then this past summer, Norman asked me to be the director of the foundation. So now I'm acting in that capacity.
Right. And what is the source of the money? I mean, initially it was Norman and David's, whatever money
husband.
David. Yeah, exactly. It was whatever money David left. And as well as, did Norman contribute some, or how did that work?
Yeah, we did. David had a gallery called Gallery Michael, which is over in Beverly Hills. And they had sold a ton of David's work. And so the foundation initially started on proceeds really from David's work, and which is an incredible, generous act, really, and to take that money and then, you know, redistribute it to other artists. So that's how we got started. And then there's always there's still money coming in from David's work that helps fund the foundation, and then of course the generosity of people who are willing to support the arts and donate. And we're a 501(c) nonprofit, so you know it's all tax deductible. But these are people who are recognizing the importance of art and culture, and that through this giving to the foundation, you're able to actually kind of influence what ends up representing culture, you know, by helping artists along with this, you know, financial award. And that help, you know, can really be a catalyst for many artists. I've experienced it myself as an Artadia grant awardee that really changed my life and, enabled me to make a bunch of work that I otherwise wouldn't be able to, and that kind of thing. So
when was that you got that grant, and what were the details?
I think
that?
I got the Artadia grant in 2002, I think, in Chicago, or 2001 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was $10,000, you know, which was, it's still a lot of money, but certainly back then, more money yet again. And that enabled me to pay off. I had most of my grad school paid for, but it allowed me to pay off, you know, the remainder of my grad school debt and move to New York, which is a very expensive thing, because you got to have first month, last month, and a security deposit in New York. So you might be talking about $6,000,
right?
You know, just to get the keys, you know?
Right.
So, and then I had a little bit of, you know, money left over from that. And when I moved to Bed-Stuy, I moved into a loft and I built a studio out in the loft and was able to operate that studio for like 5.5 years. That $10,000 went a long way,
right?
You know?
Right. So getting back to your job, though, and your history with this David Whaley Foundation, what does your job involve? I mean, what does the fundraising look like? I mean, obviously, there's a certain amount of administrative stuff. What would maybe, can you paint a picture, if you will? I said that to Laura, too. I'm going to have to retire that. What does a day look like, or what is a snapshot of some of the things you do condensed, so that we can get a sense of what that looks like for an artist to be a director of a foundation that gives away money?
Well, a big part of it is conceptualizing what we want to do and what we want to offer, you know? And so I have some pretty expansive ideas for what that can be that are not necessarily as traditional as, you know, just cutting people a check. So, I'm conceptualizing these opportunities as an artist that I see that would be really beneficial. And, that maybe somebody who's coming more from like an admin side of things wouldn't necessarily be looking into to expand what their programming could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another idea. You know, these things are not in motion yet, but they're, you know, we're looking to get funding for these things, but to offer a curator's grant. And just loosely at the moment, that would look like, you know, curators proposing an exhibition, potential artists to fill it out, and someone would get that award. They would get a monetary award personally, and then we would provide them with the infrastructure to bring the exhibition into fruition. So a space, the advertising, and the other things to go along with that. And so whilst that one curator is getting a financial benefit and getting to put on an exhibition that they want, there would be some stipulation that it'd have to be a group show, like three artists or five artists or, you know, or more. But then, you know, what you're really doing is giving one award, but it benefits like five or six people. So that's part of my job, is conceptualizing, you know, what our programming can be. Another part is networking. Obviously, I got to know a bunch of people around town, which I already, you know, do that as an artist anyway. So it kind of works for me in both directions, which is great. And then, of course, fundraising, which can be done, I think, most effectively individually, you know, with a single person or, you know, a couple of family, whatever it is. And but then, you know, there's events too. Like last year, this past summer, rather, we put on an exhibition called 3 Years, the David Whaley Foundation. And that exhibition showcased the seven artists that we've given awards to. And so that also allowed us, you know, to create a fundraising opportunity at the event itself, and then provide, you know, continuing support for the artists that we've already given grants to. So it was twofold in that regard as well.
Right. Give me an example of the individuals that you refer to, or the couples. So this sounds a lot to me like somebody who is in a head administrative position, right? Whose job isn't fundraising per se, but part of their job involves meeting people and essentially, you know, telling them how things are going, you know, asking them about what's going on with them. And then at some point, boom, would you like to give us some money?
Yes. Or, you know, it depends on how the introduction to that person is made, or if you've known them a while, or whatever the circumstances might be that bring you together. But yeah, you'd arrange to meet with the intent to discuss the foundation. So it's not like you're just, you know, blindsiding them with, you know, it'd be great if you gave the foundation some money. You know, it's known what you're meeting for. And then you've got to be convincing in selling, you know, the foundation's mission, really. And, you know, people are receptive.
So you have jurors, right? Is it for every award, or do you have, so you have the teacher's award and then you have the emerging artist award? Do the jurors make decisions on both of those, or are there separate jurors for each?
No, each round that
right.
we issue grants, there's three independent jurors. I uh-huh. pick those jurors.
Yep.
And it's a diverse, you know, group of people. One of them is always an artist that we've given an award to. So mm-hmm. so they actually make a little bit of money off of that as well. So that's another way to give back to those artists. And, you know, we very much value their opinion. And they get to help, you know, form who the next grantees are.
Right.
And that group of jurors is very diverse. And I think this is an important point, is because the jury changes every time, there's no overarching aesthetic of the foundation. It's not like we only support like painting, or we only support, you know, figuration or this or that. It changes every time. So we've given awards to sculptors, painters, installation artists, video artists, like everything.
Okay.
So,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then, so those three jurors, they oversee the disbursement of both those grants and the two residencies.
Right. And you mentioned when we spoke before something interesting that happens when the decision process is going on. So you're not a decision maker because you're not a juror yourself, but you are privy to these conversations as they're being debated. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I sit in on the process. I'm there if there's any questions, or, you know, things go, you know, wrong, or you need something or whatever. And you know, we provide them, you know, with like a light breakfast and a lunch and these things. So, you know, we're facilitating other things while we're there just to keep everybody happy and the whole thing moving. And but yeah, I get to sit in and watch the process. I don't intervene in that process. I, you know, as an artist, it's very interesting, which I think is what you're getting at, because I get to see how the back end of this works. Obviously, having applied for grants and things myself and continuing to do so. So you get a little bit of insight into how the jurors are responding to different portfolios or things that people have written in support of their argument that they should receive the grant.
So what are some big takeaways about being, you know, being exposed to that process? What would you either, what sticks out to you as maybe one particular memorable moment, and or what would you pass along to, you know, prospective grantees themselves? Hey there, it's me again. Before we continue with Nick's response, I'm just jumping in for a moment to remind you that while this is an ad-free show, it does rely on your financial support. Whatever you can give to the show, especially for this final episode of 2019 of the decade, would mean a lot. You can support the show for as little as $1 a month on Patreon. Do a one-time donation via Venmo or PayPal or old-fashioned check. And if you make a donation of $20 or more, I will send you the recent Laura Kripka and Ingrid LaFleur bonus episodes and add you to the supporters list. 35 or more, and I'll send you all 10 of the prior bonus episodes. Plus, we have an intriguing one with the creators of the platform Collectors coming up. All right, so thank you in advance for your support of the conversation. It means a lot. Now, let's return with Nick's response.
Yeah, sure. And that's something I want to do. We're going to go through this process in a couple months here. And I took notes from the last time, and I'm going to take notes again. And I want to compile that and compare the two, see how what crossover there is. And I actually want to get this information on our website to help applicants create stronger applications. You know, I hate all of the kind of firewalls that exist in the art world. They're very unnecessary. And there's no reason in the world that, you know, the organizations can't help artists make better applications for things. And a lot of these things are quite simple. So one of the main things is if you have to write a little essay or whatever it is to support your work, you know, you want to be specific about what you think you're going to do with this money, you know. And sometimes that can really sway the jurors, you know, from one artist to another. You start off with the whole, you know, batch of people, a couple hundred people or whatever the applicant list is. They go through that and then they only look really at the images unless something is particularly, you know, curious or a little difficult to discern what it is. You know, then they'll look into the writing, you know, perhaps at that point just to, so they have a clear understanding. And then they shortlist that and you might get down to, you know, it depends, each round's different, but 10, 15 people. And then they kind of, you know, will shortlist that again down to maybe three or four people. And they do start going through, you know, the writing at that point as well, because there might be, again, they need some clarification on what they're looking at. Or, you know, this looks interesting, but I'm not quite sure. So they'll read some of the information then get down to three or four people. And at that point, the writing can sway the jury. And, you know, if someone says, you know, this is my situation, this is what I'm going to do with the money, and they're quite specific about it. It's almost like a business plan. I mean, you don't have to have like all the taxes included and, you know, receipts and all this kind of thing. But, you know, the specificity, you know, they can then say, I can really see how this is going to benefit them. And they got a plan for how they're going to use this money,
right,
you know?
Right.
And you know, the plan might be pay off their student loan debt, which would then free up that money to be used to rent a bigger studio or
right.
something like that.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So it can be a little bit ancillary to the work exactly itself.
Yeah.
So that I think is something artists want to think about is just try to be specific in what you're going to do with that money. And, you know, it doesn't have to be like, in fact, it can't be like pages and pages of writing. So, you know, you just kind of be specific and terse and, that can be really helpful. Another thing is getting your images, good images, you know, and sized properly. When you resize images in Photoshop, it's not as clean and tidy as it should be. And so you just want to double check before you send everything off that it really is, you know, as big as you're allowed to make the images. It helps, you know. I've screwed this up before, too, because that Photoshop process is like a preview. And even though you save it at, say, like 5 megabytes, when you actually get to, like, see what the preview is, somehow it's like 1.2 or something. You're like, what the hell?
Right.
So you have to go back and redo it again. And it's tedious, but it's important because the images are projected. They're not massive, but they might be, you know, I don't know, 4 feet across or something, the projection, right? So it depends where we're at and who's hosting us and whatever, but, you know, for the review process. But, you know, if you've unfortunately sized your images up and they're like, you know, 1 megabyte instead of 5, your image is only going to look like 18 inches across instead of like 4 feet, you know? So it's much harder to tell what's going on.
So how do you, so you've done this before. How do you correctly size an image so that it, when it gets bumped over to a different platform, it's not going to drop down?
Well, it's not getting diminished on our platform. It's diminished when you save it on your computer. So like you do like a save as or whatever in Photoshop, and you've already made the image size so that it says it's 5 megabytes. You do a save as, and then you save it to wherever you're saving it, and you save it as a JPEG, and then you click OK or whatever. And then there's a little, you know, it gives you one last little box, and it says like image quality, and there's a slider to go from like, I don't know, 0 to 12. If you look over and find smaller print to the right of that, it'll tell you what the actual size of the image is. And, you know, it's right under the OK button or whatever to finalize that process. And it's almost never what you actually saved it as. It's the craziest thing. I'm using an older Photoshop, so maybe they fixed this now.
That's good to know.
if you don't look at that, and what happens if it suddenly says like 3 instead of 5, then you got to hit cancel and guess again, you know, go back through the whole process. When you go to image size and you resize it, you just got to make it bigger until, and you keep doing it until it actually says that it says 5, if 5 megabytes is the maximum file you can send, you know. I've even noticed when I've done that, then I go to like Slide Room or whatever, and then Slide Room's like, you know, this is too big. I'm like, what do you mean it's too big? It's I just saved it as 5. You know, it can get screwed up at that point too. So it's super tedious, and I don't understand computers very well at all. I'm like, you know, I don't know why this doesn't work more cleanly, but whatever. But anyway, it's all happening on, like, unfortunately, on the artist end. And I'm saying that as an artist.
Sure.
So,
right.
You know, once we get it, we can't, you know, we're not doing anything that's like manipulating your image bigger or smaller or anything.
Sure.
So, but it's something to look out for. I've been bamboozled by that. And then it sucks when you figure out you spent all this time on the application and your image was like a postage stamp, you know?
Yeah, that sucks.
So,
but getting back to the specificity, right, of the money, what the individual, the grantee is going to use it for. So does something, I mean, does it have to be kind of compelling, I guess, is a question? In other words, could somebody say, if I get this $5,000, I'll be able to cut down on my day job by 25%, you know, over the next 6 months, or I'll be able to rent this extension, you know, a storage area so that I can, you know, have more space to make more work in my studio for 6 months. You know what I mean? Something along those lines.
Yeah, that would be very compelling. I think anybody can see the value in that. You know, the people, our jurors are people from the art world. They're other artists, they're gallerists, curators. They understand. They've been to artist studios. They see those kinds of issues. The artist teacher grant is a great one for that because, you know, really the plight is I'm going to driving all over town, going to like 5 different jobs. I'm making no money. And this award will help me like take a semester off from one of those classes. And that frees up, you know, a ton of extra time.
Yeah.
But the Emerging Artist Grant too, like, I think Margaret Griffith, one of our awardees, actually I think that was a mid-career grant we gave to Margaret, but she had this whole plan where she was she works with Security Gates as like the main object that she's abstracting. And she wanted to use the money to fly to Washington, D.C. and document the gates of the White House. And then she was going to take that documentation, bring it back to her studio and manipulate it and And turn that into work. And that's what she did. You know, that was compelling to the jury. It was very specific, right? Like, and the money was like, okay, yes, this amount of money will actually cover that. You know, it's not like she's, you know, asking to travel around the world for a year and we're only giving her 10 grand, you know,
that's not going to work, right?
So maybe that's a concrete example that would help artists kind of understand a little bit about what we're talking about.
Right. Great. So, yeah, that helps. Thank you. One of the things that we talked about last time is struggling a little bit from time to time with under-recognition for your own work. I didn't know at the time when you told me that you had received this Arcadia grant. So that's obviously kind of changes the complexion a little bit. But to maybe frame it this way, you know, as an artist who, you know, is applying for grants himself and maybe feels like a lot of artists do, that they could have a little bit more attention, you know, or awareness about their work themselves. Does it sometimes tricky being involved in a, I mean, obviously it's very exciting probably in a lot of ways and fun, but is it sometimes challenging to be lifting other artists, you know, when you're wanting those things for yourself?
You know, it's not. I mean, I have this saying, I don't know why I came up with this a number of years ago, but it's really, I think, really helpful. And it's someone else's success is not my failure.
Right.
And I really live by that. And I love making connections for people. I do it all the time anyway. When I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this person needs to meet that person. That's going to totally work. Something will come of that. I just do it. You know, I'm not getting paid to do that. It doesn't help me directly. Maybe those two people will think more fondly of me if there's something comes of that meeting.
Right.
And then perhaps they'll reciprocate later. And I think people need to think like that much more. That kind of reciprocation and generosity, you know, that's what we need. Artists, you know, just going back to New York, you know, not to totally rip on New York. It's a great town. I mean, my favorite people are New Yorkers. Like almost all my close friends here are New Yorkers, you know. So, but, you know, people tended to covet their opportunities, at least at the time when I was there. And nobody was really getting anywhere, you know. And then here, I think people, that was another thing I did notice moving here. People were much more generous with their time, with their connections, trying to help each other. And we just need more and more of that. So it really does work. You know, people will bring each other along. And they used to. The art world used to work like that. And it stopped sometime in like the late 70s. Artists just sort of stopped doing that.
Right.
I remember listening to an interview on NPR with Richard Serra. And he specifically said that. He was brought along, if I remember correctly, by Rauschenberg and Johns. And then they said, well, who did you help along? I don't know Richard Serra from anything, but I seem to remember he was like, well, you know, artists just kind of stopped doing that sort of thing in like the late 70s, early 80s, you know? And I was like, oh, thanks a bunch, you know?
Yeah. I think your other person's success is not your failure mantra is a good one. And I think you're absolutely right that we do need more of that generosity and helping sort of unsolicited help, you know, or unreciprocated, I should say, help. But I don't think it's a New York problem. I think it's just as much a LA problem. I think it's a problem everywhere. People covet.
Yeah,
people keep private their connections a lot of the time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a problem everywhere. That's just a human problem, really, you know. But I did notice it was at the time when I lived in New York. You know, hopefully New York's different now. But at the time, and there's a shifting societal mindset towards this, I think, at this moment anyway. But, you know, at the time when I was in New York, I found it to be less the case than it is now in Los Angeles. So, you know, it could be a combination of just larger societal thinking shifts. And I just happened to be here at that time. Or maybe people here are just, you know, being a little bit more open and generous. But, you know, part of that, again, comes down to like the galleries, all the people are more accessible. So you're not feeling like you're sharing something that was so hard won, you know, if you're making a personal connection to someone.
Yeah.
Because it's just not that hard here, you know, where in New York it was like impossible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that had something to do with it, too. But yeah, as far as being under-recognized, I mean, you know, it's all in shades, right? Like, I mean, I've had shows, like a solo show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, at the Drawing Center in New York City. And, you know, like I mentioned, I had Catherine Brintz into my studio from Guggenheim, you know, not too long ago. And I've had tons of studio visits in the last like 18 months, like I think 25 studio visits with some pretty major galleries and stuff. So I'm like, I feel very much right on the cusp of things. The problem is I've been on that cusp for like 20 years, you know?
Yeah.
So, but what happens, you know, and I'm sure you're aware, but, you know, when you're underrepresented, you know, you're showing your work maybe a little bit, but you don't have a gallery working on your behalf, which not all galleries really seem to do anyway. So you got to have like a good gallery that's really trying to work for you. But, you know, there's very little income coming in from your artwork, which is your main job, really. So you have to have other jobs to help support, you know, your main job that's not really paying. And so then you have much less time in the studio. And because you're not, you know, making the kind of money you might be able to make if your work was selling, then, you know, you have a smaller studio space. And then that smaller studio space, you know, it's harder to reach your maximum potential because you're crammed in this little joint, you know, trying to make things. And if you're ambitious, you know, your ambitions just can't be met in that with those kind of constraints, both financial and space wise and time, you know, because then time is always the biggest component, really. But anyway, so, you know, I think that those are the sort of like effects of being underrecognized where, you know, you see, like I have a friend who does very, very well, shows with a big blue chip gallery. He's a great dude. And he was telling me he had this idea for a piece. The gallery came by the studio to check in, to see what's going on, you know, keep up to date with what he's doing. And they're, of course, always trying to, you know, get him other shows with other galleries and other spaces in between the sort of 2 years between your solo shows. And he pitched them this idea for this piece, and it needed to be in cast bronze. And he's like, there's no way I ever could have made this thing on my own. But they were like, yeah, that sounds great. We'll pay for it to be cast. You know, it's this big, massive sculpture. And they said, we'll make it in an edition, you know. And so they went and, you know, talked to their collectors that they have that support him. And, you know, the whole thing was like pre-sold. So they could just, you know, look at the numbers and say, no problem. It's going to cost us X to have, you know, five of these things cast. And they're all sold for Y, which is, you know, three times as much money. So everyone's going to make money. It's no problem for them to foot the bill for that. But this artist, there's no way he could have just made that piece on his own, especially not as a multiple either, you
right,
know?
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, he's able to bring work into fruition on like the highest level that he needs it to be achieved at because he's got that support where like, you know, if I conjure up something for like some big bronze ass sculpture, it's never going to happen. You know,
yep.
It's a really expensive process. So, you know, when galleries or museums come to your studio and want to see what you're doing, you know, you got to be making really high quality work no matter what, but you know, you're not necessarily able to show them like what you can really do.
Right. But don't you think it doesn't have to be limited by size? Like ambition doesn't equal bigger or more expensive materials necessarily. I mean, it's
no,
about working
not.
Within
I mean,
limits,
you got,
isn't it?
I missed the last part of what
it's
you said,
about
sorry.
Working within your own limits financially as well as otherwise.
Yes, of course. I mean, a good example of that might be like Richard Tuttle, right? Like, I love that guy's work. And it tends to be very modest in scale, modest in materials and all that kind of thing. I mean, you got to be good. You know, there's no way around it.
Of course.
But, you know, you might be really good and still have things that you'd like to make that, you know, even if you make modest scale work and modest materials, you can't even see it all together if you're in a small studio. You know, you don't have enough space
sure.
to hang it all up and kind of see what it looks like as an exhibition or
right.
like, you know, there's just, you know, it's problematic is all. And,
yeah.
and you know, of course, not everyone gets to be a well-represented artist and all this stuff. You know, we understand it's not necessarily fair, but we're just discussing, you know, for there are people who could be having stronger careers who don't. And, you know, they're, you know, there's obviously a negative effect to that. But, you know, going back to the grant organization, that's hopefully what, you know, issuing grants to emerging artists. These are people who generally don't have, you know, solid representation. They're underrepresented. And so hopefully those grants help alleviate some of these issues for them, at
right.
least for, you know, a brief period of time, you know. So anyway, so that
so
all
you,
kind of ties in nicely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You talked about the time constraints. Like you want to be working on your work a certain amount of time minimum. And then you have all these, you know, if you're not making a living from your work, you got to be doing this other work for pay. And so you've got this, you're the director of this foundation, right? Which you told me is basically a full-time situation, but you're also still teaching the UCLA extension, right? So are you, I mean, I can understand why you would do that, you know, because that was the job that got you this foundation thing in the first place, but you're also, you know, you're limiting your time in the studio by taking on both of those things.
Yeah, I mean, the foundation job is not paying, I think, what a person might imagine that a foundation job pays.
Ah, okay.
You know, we're you know, just this will be our fourth year of issuing grants. And so, you know, we have to, well, I really specifically have to work on our fundraising and continue to build the foundation, you know, financially to become stronger and stronger. And I'm excited about that opportunity. And then on top of that, I just love teaching. It's, you know, a lot of people who teach and have done it for a long time, like I've done it on and off for 20 years. You only do it because you love it. I mean, it's hard. It's exhausting. I don't think people understand if you never taught. You know, you come home from teaching for 3 hours and you are wiped out.
Right.
It's just mentally exhausting. But I really, really love it. And teaching at UCLA Extension has, you know, brought me other ancillary benefits, as you say, ultimately becoming the director of this foundation. And there's other things as well. But, you know, and just the cachet, I've been introduced to people, you know, they're like, oh, this is Nick. He's a really great painter. And their eyes sort of roll back in their head, you know. And then someone else introduced me to them like 6 months later. And they're like, oh, this is Nick. He's a great painter. He teaches at UCLA Extension. And they're like, what do you do? How's everything? But, you know, like, the work is the same, you jackass, you know?
So what, the UCLA Extension cachet, that was what changed their perspective?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. There is that for sure.
What are the different ways that you sell your work?
Oh, on your own? Can't be collectors that have developed over time, you know, like, so, you know, the person actually in person. And then those people buy repeatedly, which of course is very appreciated. And then I've been able to sell some work via Instagram,
wow.
much more affordable work. So I make these little tiny watercolors. They're like 5 inches by 7 inches. And those are very affordable. And I do pretty well selling those. And
so people just reach out to you. They see them on Instagram. They just reach out to you and say how much?
Yeah, I put the price there with it. So
It's
very specifically, you know, put up for sale.
Okay.
And at certain times, you know, I've been making kind of, I call them watercolor meditations. And so it's a specific, very specific little project. I sit down, I do this thing in a time frame. And then I put them up and they, you know, it's just the title of the piece, watercolor meditation number, whatever. I just finished the 50th one actually. And then the size and the price and that's it. And then, so people are like, oh, that thing is that much money. I want that. And
right.
then, you know, they reach out to you and, you know, they sell. And so that's helpful. It's like a little bit of money, but you know, when you put it on repeat a fair bit, it adds up. So that's good too. So yeah, it's just worth prioritizing enough time in the studio. Unfortunately, I've been able to figure out ways to do that. You know, even going back to bartending, you know, you do that at night and you can bartend when you're tired, but you can't make artwork when you're tired. So I always found I could paint, you know, from about noon to 7 o'clock at night, go home, take a shower, go straight to the bar and then work till 5 in the morning, you know, and that's what I did for years.
I want to ask you about these collectors because I don't think we should just bypass the fact that you have these collectors who buy multiple pieces, I guess, or at least a couple in some cases. And I imagine that these are some of your bigger, more ambitious pieces. How tricky is that to have a collector base when you don't have a gallery for work that is probably, you know, not inexpensive, to say the least?
Well, it's not typically like the – it's not the biggest work.
It's not the 8 feet by 6 feet works we're talking about.
No, no, it's not.
Okay.
No, but
okay.
It's the more modest work. Yeah, the more modest work, I definitely – you know, I have things that range all the way from those 5 by 7 inch little watercolors, you know, to the 8 foot paintings, oil paintings. So there's things all over the place in between. And so, yeah, they're just people who – you know, from time to time, it's not that frequent, but, you know, they'll buy a piece. I have one collector who, you know, I had to, I was really broke. Things were looking bleak a couple of Decembers ago. And I was like, oh man, this is, I'm in a really bad place here. You know, just kind of had a bad year. And then she just called me up and said she wanted to come over and see what I had. And she came over and bought like $10,000 worth of work. So,
wow,
you know, that was great.
That's the paganism is really paying off there, huh?
Man, I was burning everything. You
yeah,
know?
Nice. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
that's an incredible, getting what you wish for scenario.
Yeah, it was quite serendipitous. I got to tell you, I just walked around in a daze the rest of the day. I mean, it was not good, you know, financially.
Right.
And then, you know, what I think what happens is when you get a windfall like that, you suddenly all the stress is relieved from you that you didn't realize you were carrying around, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just literally felt like I was like sort of floating about and I was in a daze. It was just like this whole crushing stress had just been dissipated. And my body just didn't know what to do. It was like, oh, all that shit's gone. You know what I mean?
Right.
So anyway, you know, obviously that money was very helpful. And it kind of got me through a couple months. And then things kind of clicked back into normal. You know, it's just it's precarious being an artist, as artists are aware. So you just have to, you know, keep throwing a bunch of lines out, you know, in the water. And hopefully you're catching something all the time. But, you know, sometimes you're not. So,
sure.
Yeah.
And do you think there was a confidence factor as well? I mean, it sounds like, as you said, you know, after a couple of months, you kind of things click back to normal. But when you have that kind of, in addition to the, you know, the stress lifting that went on, is there a, you know, does that, when you approach your work again, do you feel like, yeah, you know, I'm making something of value and, you know, I can kind of, it sort of alleviates maybe the anxiety or the insecurity around the making to some extent.
You know, I'm sure it does in some regard that's more subconscious.
Right.
But I've just been doing this for 20 years, you know, I'm almost 20 years out of graduate school and been able to do it for that long. And, it's just a no matter what. It's like a by any means necessary, I'm making artwork. And, you know, the financial part doesn't ever seem to really, it doesn't make me feel like the work's better or worse. You know, I have a funny little anecdote, which I tell my students sometimes. I applied for New American Paintings a number of years ago. And I'd gotten into it straight out of grad school. And I was like, oh, it's just something you sort of do when you're just out of grad school, trying to get a little traction or something. But anyway, I've had these career arcs where, like, I had, you know, major museum shows and then no shows for like a couple years. And you're like, what the hell happened? You know, and it's like, I'm not doing anything different or whatever. So these ups and downs I'm really used to. And so I thought, well, I better just start over in a way. And so I applied for New American Paintings and, you know, you sent in your 5 images or whatever, and I didn't get in. And I was really pissed. I was like, what, are you kidding me? I'm like, get out of here with this. So the next year it came along again. And this time, I can't remember the woman's name off the top of my head, but the juror was from the San Francisco Museum of San Francisco MoMA. And she's great. And so I thought, well, this is good. It's worth the $50 to apply just so she sees my work, you know, which I think is another thing people need to think about when they apply to stuff is like, who's the juror?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're getting your work seen by these people. And that's just hard to do in the first place, you know. And I should say that the David Whaley Foundation applications are free. So, you know, there's no reason not to apply.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, so I applied again, but I thought, you know, to the New American Paintings, and I thought, screw them. I'm going to apply with the exact same 5 images I applied with last year.
Right.
And so I did, and then I got in, and I was like, see, sometimes you don't need better work. You need a better viewer.
Right.
And that was the case here. So, you know, I think that that's always kind of been my mentality, is that, like, you know, it's not the work, you know, it's like getting the right people to see it and who understand. And, you know, I've got people who get it. Just unfortunately, at the moment, it's like, I really do have some great connections in galleries that are like blue chip galleries that are interested in my work, you know, but it's the middle, you know, the mid tier galleries and stuff that aren't necessarily responding to it in the way that, that I need them to, because it's hard to just, you know, jump the whole queue and go from, like, you know, just being in your garage to suddenly being in a blue chip gallery. Right. So, you know, so it's some alignment that you need there, where the work is the work. You have to be confident in it. And, you know, you always have to be questioning yourself to keep moving it forward. And I feel like I've definitely done that, challenging yourself and never being satisfied. Otherwise, you get stuck. But the financial part never comes into it. I mean, I would be thrilled if I sold out like a solo show, of course, you know. And I'm sure it gives you some confidence in that. But, you know, when it gets back to getting in the studio and starting again, you know, you're always kind of like, oh, how's this going to work out? You know, you can have a plan and the whole thing. I do a lot of preliminary work and all this stuff for each piece. But, you know, you never know until it's done, you know. So that's a very kind of internal little war that you're having all the time. And I don't think any external things can convince you to keep doing it or in a way, you know, some people are just financially so buried that they can't keep making work, you know what I mean?
Right.
But so there can be some externals that cause you to quit, but, you know, maybe there's some other way you find to express yourself that's more ephemeral, you know, through writing or through, you know, whatever, music or some other thing. A lot of artists have a capacity to work in in multiple media. So, you know, it's just kind of having to shift gears or something. But anyway, sorry, it's a long answer to your question.
Did anything end up coming from the second round of the New American Paintings?
No, I didn't.
Okay,
I didn't.
Good to know, because that's, I think that I've gotten at least from one person sort of the pros and cons, or like, you know, it was ultimately kind of as to the value of it. It just seems like that pay-to-play thing, you know, is always a little suspect.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why I mentioned it. I mean, I really almost never do anything you got to pay for.
Right.
But in that situation, the juror is, you know, the head of painting and sculpture at San Francisco MoMA. So, you know, if you said, hey, if you give me $50, I'll show her your work.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, yeah, okay, I'll probably do that.
Sure. Yeah. Good point.
So, yeah. But if it's someone who's, you know, I mean, and that's not to undermine people in lesser positions. You know, you can't do that either, because they're never where they are for long. You know what I mean? People move around and all that kind of stuff too. So, but generally, yeah, I think the pay to play model is to be avoided. So,
yeah. Well, Nick, this has been fun. Thanks for talking. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man, it was great. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, you bet. And we're out. Thanks again to Nick. Before I get to more on the search for a co-host, I want to thank all the ongoing Patreon and PayPal supporters of the show. Thank you so much for your continued support. I really appreciate it. And also a big, big thanks to the Conversation team, each invaluable in their own way. Producers Andy Davis, Amanda Roth, Adam Vail, Liz Flynn, and social media guru Liliana Karadavukian. Thank you so much to all of you guys. So back to the co-host plan. I was talking with a guy who made this suggestion, and I thought it made sense, even though I have delved into it kind of here and there in years past. It seems like a great time to bring on another charismatic voice who adds another dimension to our conversations and will enable me or us to have episodes ongoing without necessarily relying on an extra guest, and add a new flavor and tenor to the dialogue as well. So I'm going to be exploring this approach with some contributors, present and past, to the show, and hopefully turn that into an episode soon. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, go ahead and make your pitches, whether you, somebody you know, somebody you don't know, for co-hosts of The Conversation. And thank you very much for listening. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Happy end of the decade, 2019. And I will talk to you then. Until then, ciao for now.